You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, painstakingly patient, pacing patrons of paleobiology while paying for paintballs. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 263, and of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your squishy and squeezable squabbling squires squaring away squiggles.
I'm Colin.
And I'm Chris.
There's some commotion. There has been a bit of a, let's call it a snowball fight that we've learned from our Lobetrotters group. Colin, in the last episode, one of your questions about the world's tallest slash biggest snow person.
Snow person. Yes, I had scarcely just finished telling you guys on the show that Olympia in Bethel, Maine, was the world's tallest snowman. 2 days later, Karen, you said, uh-oh, Colin, commotion from Lobetrotters, and you pasted a link to an article from the Lewiston Sun Journal. Title of the article is, Olympia, no longer the world's tallest snowman. And I was like, "What? Dang it, what the heck is going on?" So I read the article, and it's talking about how a team of snow builders in Austria in February 2020 apparently built a giant snow person named Risi, nearly 125 feet tall, which would make it 2 feet and change taller than Olympia the Snow Woman. So now I read the article and I was like, okay, all right, really? Like, is it? I want to see Guinness. I want to see that this is certified, right?
Because you sourced it from Guinness.
So the very first thing I did, I went back to the Guinness website. I'm like, what the heck? Nope, the page still says world's tallest snow person, good old Olympia Snow Woman, Bethel. So I was like, what's going on here? So I entered into sort of a web news circularity situation where I found a lot of articles sourcing each other, but I did not find any kind of primary source. And I certainly did not find anything official from the Guinness Book of World Records people on their website. Nothing I could find. So I was digging and digging and digging.
You can't hide a giant snow person.
To be clear, I'm not suggesting that this thing was a figment of someone's imagination or like a
hoax.
Oh,
I'm sure they did it.
A hoax. No, I mean, there are photos and I saw photos of Risi. Now, yeah, I mean, I have to say, in my opinion, I'm just going to say his hat is very tall. I'm just going to leave it at that. I'm just going to say, like, okay, you're going for the record. Like, it's tallest snow person, not snow person with tallest hat, right? You know what I'm saying? Anyway, so the article you sent me quoted MSN. I dug a little bit. I could not find the MSN article, but I found a lot of other articles all sort of quoting each other. I found a Reddit thread talking about Risi holding the record for tallest snowman ever, with a pretty good picture of Risi. So I was not satisfied. Eventually, I ended up on an article.
You found him.
From the Bangor Daily News from January of this year. Maine still holds the world record for the tallest snowman.
What happened to the other one?
Good question, Karen. All right. So in this article by Emily Burnham goes into great detail. I will spare you recapping the whole history of Olympia Snow Woman. Go listen to the last episode. We covered it in some good detail. The people in Austria built this thing. They did say that they applied to Guinness to have the record certified. And at that point, it sort of just got a life of its own on the web. Like, the stories were kind of quoting something that was not, in fact, official, all right? According to the Bethel Chamber of Commerce, the Guinness people did not verify the record, and they later said that, in fact, their attempt was disqualified. As far as Guinness is concerned, Olympia is still the record holder for world's tallest snow person. I found a small article on BethelMaine.com under bethelmaine.com/snowpeople, talking about how Bethel, Maine was home to the world's tallest snowman in 1999, topped their own record in 2008. In February of 2020, it was widely reported that our record was beaten by people in the town of Donnersbachwald, Austria. Many news outlets from around the world shared this information. However, we learned later that year that the Austrian record was disqualified. We never learned the reason why.
Yeah.
We were simply told, quote, if it's in the book, you still have the record. It is impossible to correct the entire internet. So we'll just say it here. Our record still stands. So that is the voice of Bethel, Maine, carrying the torch for Olympia Snow Woman. Still world record holder, despite...
Snow mic drop.
Yeah, snow mic drop. Yeah. I cannot fault our diligent listeners for being led astray, because there was quite a bit of coverage on the internet.
So we just don't know why it was disqualified. It could be they didn't get... a checker or auditor. It could be the hat.
Yeah, those records might be sealed, right? I'm gonna keep on digging for sure. if I uncover the dirt here, I will let you know precisely why it was not certified.
It could be the hat.
And listeners, I have one quick actually language changes. Last episode I talked about kaffir lime leaves, and I was notified that now people call it a makrut lime. Makrut lime leaf. Because kaffir is a not nice word in South Africa.
All right. Good to note that.
Makrut lime, not kaffir lime. All right. That was a lot of ado. Without further ado, let's jump into our first general trivia segment. Pop quiz, hotshot. Here I have a random Trivial Pursuit card. It is Pop Culture 2.
Okay.
You guys have your barnyard buzzers. Let's answer some questions. Blue Wedge for TV. What reality show required host Phil Keegan to fly the equivalent of 10 laps around the Earth in a year? Chris.
The Amazing Race.
Correct! Sorry if I pronounce his name wrong. All right. Pink Wedge for Fad, what libation, when mixed with rum and whipped cream, do Viennese call a fiaker?
Oh, no.
Colin.
Coffee.
It is coffee.
Yeah.
Viennese
great.
Coffee.
Nice.
Yellow Wedge, Buzz, what star of Desperado claims she once told men who'd kidnap her, kill me, I believe in reincarnation. I'll just come back.
Wow.
What a strange question.
What a strange question. Desperado.
Starred in Desperado. I don't
know. Okay.
Chris.
Selma Hayek.
Yes!
Oh!
Selma Hayek.
It popped into my head and I'm like, I think there's a reason that's there.
Purple Wedge Music. What's Ozzy Osbourne's given name?
Sure. Yeah.
Does Sharon ever call him that on the Osbournes? Does she ever
Colin. Just first name.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Stuart.
That's a pretty good guess. Yeah. No.
Aloysius.
It is John. Here we go. Green Wedge for movies. What Shrek 2 character coughed up the most hairballs? Chris.
It would have to be Puss in Boots.
Yes, correct. You're correct.
It better be Puss in Boots.
Because he's a cat.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Last question. Sports and games. What Maxis computer game lets you build your own wild animal park?
That's a good question.
Colin.
I'm not going to overthink it. Is it just SimCity?
Incorrect.
Okay.
So there's Sim City, there's Sim Farm, but it's not Sim Farm. It's not Sim. I don't think it's Sim Zoo. I don't think there's anything called Sim Zoo. Wild Animal Park. Sim. It's like a preserve.
Safari. Was there a Sim?
Sim Safari.
Really? Okay. Yes. All right.
Good guess. All right. Good job, brains.
Crazy.
So today's episode, weird topic. Our topic, our theme is hard. H-A-R-D, hard. What was the inspiration? Well, listeners, you will never know, but this season I've done some, we've recorded some quizzes that I have concocted, and it turns out they were too hard. hard to a point where it's like listening to it is like not really fun.
Punishing.
This happens. That's okay. So I was like, oh, that'd be an interesting thing. Just things that are difficult or things that are physically hard. So this week, we're going on hard mode.
All right. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, Karen, you said it. I mean, sometimes those quizzes are too difficult. I sometimes feel like maybe my quizzes are too easy. And if this is the hard mode episode, I decided to create a very, very hard quiz. this quiz is hard. It is difficult. I really want to level up here on Good Job Brain. I'm going to have some questions that are just absolutely nails hard, difficult questions. And if you guys can get these, I'll be very impressed. Now, there is a theme, so maybe the theme will be able to help you here, but you know, good luck figuring it out. So here we go. It's the hard quiz. It's a write-down quiz.
Okay.
Get your piece of paper. 12 questions in the quiz. Get ready for some absolute total stumper questions. You're laughing. You're laughing, but I'm going to destroy you with
these. I'm nervous now. I'm legitimately nervous.
If and when you hear these questions and you're like, I have no idea, you know, don't worry. It's a really hard quiz. Like, don't rack your brain about it. Just move on. Maybe it'll come to you. All right. That's all. Right. You know, maybe it'll come to you later, but probably not because it's too difficult. Themed quiz. You're writing them down. Here we go. Question number one. What was the title of the allegorical play written by Bulgarian playwright Yordan Radakov in 1974? What was the title of the allegorical play written by Bulgarian playwright Yordan Radakov in 1974? Yordan Radakov.
Oh my goodness.
Jordan, sort of like Jordan with a Y, Radakov, like radish, but with a D, K-O-V at the end. 1974. So don't put any of his allegorical plays that...
prior to that. Yeah,
1974,
it's... Winnowing them down is
play
the
written by Bulgarian playwright
challenge.
Yordan Radakov. Wow. So, okay. Well, you're writing these down. So here's the thing. I want to see it. You just write it down basically because it is a theme round. So,
okay.
You know, write it down and just, you know, keep it safe. And then we'll see at the end who's doing what. So question number two, assuming you already wrote down your answers.
Yes.
Question number two, what was the title on the seventh track of indie rock band, the Appleseed Cast's 2006 album Peregrine? So just in case you didn't get that, question number two, this is trivia. This might come up one day. What was the title of the seventh track of indie rock band, the Appleseed Cast 2006 album Peregrine? Okay. Write down your answers. Question three, what was the town in England where gold prospector William Billy Barker was born? What is the town in England where gold prospector William Billy Barker was born? Question number four. What was the Finnish metal band best known for its 2008 studio album, Anthems for the Rejected? Finnish metal band best known for its 2008 studio album, Anthems for the Rejected. That's question four. Question number five. What island off the coast of Scotland boasts St. Adrian's Chapel, as well as sightings of over 285 bird species?
Oh, name of island?
Name of the island. The coast of Scotland has St. Adrian's Chapel, as well as sightings of over 285 different bird species. That's amazing, isn't it? That's question five. Question six. I hope you're, maybe you've got one or two of these, you know.
Half of them for sure.
Question number six. Question six. What mountain played host to the ski and snowboard events of the 2006 California Winter Games.
Oh my God.
Just think back to watching the 2006 California Winter Games on TV. It's the mountain that played host to the ski and snowboard events. Okay, all right. Question number 7. What is the gamer name, the gamer handle, of professional StarCraft player Park Sung-joon? That's question 7. What's the gamer name of professional StarCraft player Park Sung-joon? All right, I'm sure the theme is starting to emerge here as you're writing down your answers. Question number eight. What 1986 Eric Clapton album featured It's in the Way That You Use It? What 1986 Eric Clapton album featured It's in the 86. Way That You Use It? Yes. Question 8. 86 Eric Clapton album featuring It's in the Way That You Use It. Write down that answer. Question number 9. What 1978 Earth, Wind, and Fire song was later added to the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry?
Got it.
Question number 9. What 1978 Earth, Wind, and Fire song was later added to the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry? Question number 10. What 1917 revolution put Lenin and the Bolsheviks into power in Russia? Question number 10. What 1917 revolution put Lenin and the Bolsheviks into power in Russia? Question number 11. What is the letter N in the NATO phonetic alphabet? Question 11. What is the letter N in the NATO phonetic alphabet?
Yeah. All right.
Question number 12. I know you're never going to get all the questions in my extremely hard quiz, so I'm going to give you question number 12. Question number 12. This was the second of several hit singles from the 1995 album by alternative rock group Collective Soul.
Wow.
Wow.
The second of several hit singles from the 1995 album by alternative rock group Collective Soul is question number 12. So, as I said, this is a really hard quiz, a lot of really hard questions, extremely difficult trivia. There is a theme. So, in about 5 more seconds, I'm going to ask you to put your answers up, and we will see how many points each of you has gotten. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, answer sheets up. Let's see. Karen says question 1, January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December. Colin says the same thing. Yes, absolutely. January, allegorical player by Bulgarian playwright Jordan Radikoff in 74. February, 7th track on indie rock band The Appleseed Cast 2000 album.
Hold on. Green.
March.
Did you even listen to that song?
No, absolutely not. Have you? 3, town in England where gold prospector William Billy Barker was born. That is March. April is the Finnish metal band best known for its 2008 studio album, Anthems for the Rejected. Island of May off the coast of Scotland, really famous. They've seen puffins? Over 285 puffins and all kinds of stuff. They go there to watch seabirds like all the time. They've got video cameras set up on it because so many different seabirds show up there. June Mountain in California. June Mountain, popular place for skiing and snowboarding. Number 7, weirdly enough, ironically enough,
the person named June.
Park Sung June, his gamer name is July. 86 Eric Clapton album. August by Eric Clapton. 86. It's in the way that you use it. Question number 9 may have been a bit too easy looking back. Fire song. It was later to the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. Was September. The October Revolution put Lenin and the Bolsheviks into power in Russia. Letter N in the NATO phonetic alphabet is November. And the second of several hit singles from the 95 album by Collective Soul was December. So you guys,
that was
somehow
incredible.
What a troll quiz.
My extremely hard quiz.
The light went on when I saw Karen's light go on. Karen's light went on, I think, in September when you had Earth, Wind, and Fire. Yeah, Karen's like, oh, got it. And then I'm like, how could she get it from, wait a minute. 12 questions, and then it was good. And it was like, you had just good level design there, Chris, because it was like you had the inkling, and then the very next question lets us confirm that we have it correct. Like, okay, right, October sure, Revolution. Yeah. That was great. That was good.
I mean, not that this is a work postmortem on a project.
Yeah.
I would probably keep all of the questions super hard and obscure and left September in.
Very
I was
nice.
Just, it was more of like, I wonder what would happen if I did this. Yes. Yeah.
Not me. I'm not saying this is me, but like, honestly, how many of these would be actually guessable questions? All right. I mean, like... September, yeah, you know, October Revolution, November, December. So I feel like those last four, definitely. Eric Clapton, that's totally gettable. You could know the gamer.
He also didn't word the questions in a regular trivia the way that we usually would word, right?
For
that we
sure.
would put in clues or insinuate.
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah.
Of course,
you on
of
purpose
course.
Is like, what is this? 1974 right. obscure play.
Yeah, I think like an 8 would be a very impressive just pure trivia score. Like if
I'd
you had
be,
enough time
I'd be
to, yeah.
blown away because so many of these things are like the absolute like, well, that's the thing, you know, it does really go to show you that there really is an art to writing a trivia question.
Absolutely.
Literally just asking a question about something. It's, you know, it should be gettable. There should be clues in it that would lead the average person to sort of be able to try to figure it out if they've
totally.
Heard of it before.
You should never feel like you're just floundering around. Yeah, no, that was great.
Thank you for coming along on the troll quiz.
It's hard to, in some ways, articulate what makes a bad question until you hear a bad question. And as you noted, you know, at one point on an early show, Chris, like, we could easily stump each other 10 out of 10. Like each of us has such obscure knowledge that we could, if we wanted to, just come in and just stump each other. But that's not fun for anybody involved. And, you know.
Yeah. All right. Good job. Thank you, Chris.
Oh, sure. No
We're
problem.
Warmed up now, at
I'll
least.
Never do it again. Yeah.
From rage. All right. Well, I'm going to ask another pop quiz. Pop quiz hot shot for you guys off the dome on the subject of world history.
Mm.
What color do you associate the British military with?
Ooh.
Red.
Red. Yes. Why, Colin?
Oh,
red coats. Just as
red coats.
Yeah. Going way back to our nation's fierce revolution.
For a really long time, the British military used to wear red as part of their military uniform. It was obviously it was phased out by the 20th century. Like they changed into khakis, which was way more makes way more sense.
Yeah.
And now, you know, British military is in camo. It's kind of similar to all of the militaries all over the world because it's effective. The British infantrymen and most military wore these iconic red coats between 16th and 19th century. So it had a good run.
Mm.
For today's topic on hard, initially I wanted to do something about shells. I talk about lobsters a lot. I was thinking about like seashells, you know, having a hard exterior, maybe animals that have shells like tortoises or like exoskeleton, like insects and creatures with their skeletons on the outside exoskeleton. So I'm going to talk about the cochineal.
Oh.
sounds dirty. C-O-C-H-I-N-E-A-L. Cochineal. You've probably heard of this before. It's a beetle.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty popular kind of fun fact that shows up on the internet or shows up on TV, especially when we talk about weird food ingredients
right.
or additives, right? Before the time of synthetic dyes, people relied on natural sources for coloring, for dyes, for pigments. And so cochineal is a beetle that they grind up the female beetles and then they mix it with other chemicals to produce dye, also known as carmine, right? So red dye, this is what we currently call natural red 4. Natural red 4 is made up of processed, ground up cochineal beetles, their shells, their bodies mixed up with other chemicals.
I know it makes sense, but yeah, when I see natural, I think, you know, it's from plants or something like that. I don't think it's from beetles.
Oh yeah, it's like, the skins of berries.
That is natural, yeah.
Natural Red 4 is used to, used in a lot of different ways, cosmetics, but mostly it's used to color meat to add a bit of a oomph, a little bit of a pop to meat products, especially like salami or cured meats, to have that like deep, vibrant maroon red. And it's thermally stable, which is why people use it, because it doesn't really change that much. It's not volatile. When we hear about the carmine beetle or the cochineal beetle, it stops there. Like, oh, did you know your food has ground up beetle? How gross. And like the trivia stops there. But I've discovered a story so fascinating, I just had to share. So the female cochineal beetle, they're not like roaming around everywhere and anywhere, right? Like
many,
you can't just find them.
Not as many as it would be otherwise. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they specifically only feed on prickly pear cactus. Prickly pear cactus. They're kind of like the flat, upside down teardrop shaped cactus with kind of growing on top of each other. They only feed on prickly pear cactus, which means cochineal beetles only live where prickly cacti live. And this is South America, Central America, and the Southwest region of the United States. In the late 1700s, Spain and Portugal had a monopoly on cochineal red dye because they had colonized most of South America. Yeah. Yay. Not yay. Boo. And so, of course, Spain and Portugal controlling the regions that have this cactus, thus controlling the cochineal beetle. And of course, the British rule was like, hey, we want to control our own red dye source too. Our military coats are red. We need this red dye. We need our own source of red dye. And so the Brits tried to start their own carmine red dye industry. And so they looked around. They're like, all right, what we got? Okay, what countries do we have? Australia. Oh, great. Australia, kind of like a desert. Has desert-like conditions.
Yeah, it's hot.
It's hot. It's dry. Let's make that our HQ for farming these beetles. Let's grow a bunch of cactus there. What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
So Mr. Captain Arthur Phillip traveled to Brazil, collected some beetles, collected some a beetle-infested cactus and sailed on over to Australia. This plan epically failed because, first of all, the bugs just all died. Second of all, they were right. The prickly pear cactus loved the conditions. They thrived in the conditions. The cactus loved their new Australian digs so much that it started to take over.
Oh no.
Fields of this cactus. Oh, like you can't even, you can't get anywhere. Like it took over 100,000 square miles, almost the size of New Zealand in Australia. It's from the Queensland government, and I quote, acknowledged as one of the greatest biological invasions of modern times, introduction and subsequent spread of prickly pear into Queensland and New South Wales had infested millions of hectares of rural land, rendering it useless, completely useless, so useless that people just abandoned their land. I can't imagine doing it now. Like,
the prickly pears have it now. It's too late.
Yeah. Well, what do you do? So clearly the solution is, let's introduce another bug that eats the cactus.
Yes.
And I don't, it's so funny because I feel like Australia, so many times throughout the 10 years of the show, Australia always has these, the frog eats the fly, yes, the cat yes. eats the frog, and the dog eats the cat.
Yeah,
and,
what is it with Australia?
Yeah. They introduce this moth called, this is the scientific name, Cactoblastus, to blast some cactus. Cactoblastus moth, introduced in 1926. So this moth, it's not native to Australia. They had to get this moth from Argentina. They introduced at first 3,000 moth eggs. In the next generation, there was 2.5 million eggs, and they were distributed. And they ate the cactus into pulpy mess.
Wow.
And brought it under control. However, life finds a way.
However.
They needed Jeff Goldblum to tell them not do any of this.
Yes.
Okay.
Now they're finding new cactus varieties that aren't very attractive to the moths anymore. And so, yeah, so this is just like, this really is the nature's game of the old lady who swallowed a fly.
Yes, yes, yes. And you end up with super moth resistant cactus, all just because the British wanted more red coats.
How crazy is that? Thanks, England.
Thanks for throwing a wrench into the ecosystem of Australia.
Wow.
Just kidding. I love you, England. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Good Job Brain. Smooth puzzles, smart trivia. Good Job Brain.
And we're back. Today, we're talking about things that are hard, physically or mentally, or maybe emotionally.
This has been a tough show.
Those are not mutually exclusive. I'm feeling a little tender right now. Yeah. I think talking about what makes a good trivia question is a good segue into what I want to chat about. In prepping for the show, I was really fixated on the idea of hard puzzles. Right.
Mm.
And, you know, not to get too philosophical, but we're going to get a little philosophical. What does it mean when we say a game or a puzzle? Like, what do we mean? We say it's hard. It's one of those words. It seems so intuitive. Oh, that was really hard. Well, what do you mean? What do you mean it was hard? It's like,
oh, Colin, I know you don't use Facebook, but me and Chris are on Facebook, and they're in the Lobetrotters discussion. There was a very interesting connections puzzle the other day. And people in the group are talking about it. And it's so divisive. I'm in the camp where I was like, that was so hard. I got it, but I was sweating. It was hard. And there's some people are like, oh, I got it right away. And I think that sweat, the sweating, I don't know how to describe that, but I need that sweating aspect to make a puzzle feel hard.
Oh, like I got that little skin flush. Okay, it's interesting. But I mean, I think it's also interesting that you contrasted it with people saying, oh, I got it right away. Like, I feel like however we want to add the middle steps, it comes down to time. When we say a puzzle is hard, on some level, to be a little reductive, we mean it took a long time. You know, like it's almost as simple as that. And that can take a lot of forms, meaning I had to think about it for a long time, or it was very physically precise. And a jigsaw puzzle, I've seen these, you guys probably have, you know, it's hundreds of pieces and they're all one color. It's kind of tedious, but it's solvable. It's just, you got to kind of work your way through it. That's hard, even if it's not taxing your brain. Yeah. So I was kind of going with the angle of puzzle in some sense is harder the longer it takes to solve. Then I remembered back to a story that I first came across about a year ago, maybe a little bit more. I want to tell you about a puzzle that was commissioned, really, by a man named A.J. Jacobs. And you might recognize his name. Oh. It might sound familiar.
He's the writer for Esquire, right?
He also has written a lot for Mental Floss, among other places. So before we get to exactly what his puzzle is, have you heard the term of a generation puzzle? Have you heard this term before in the Mm-mm. puzzling world? Do you remember when we were at SporkleCon some weeks ago? The three of us, we got into a conversation with someone else about Rubik's Cubes and speed cubing.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not even going to say what the world record is. I think the last time I mentioned it on the show, it was broken the very next day. Even if you're a speed cuber, you know your path forward. It's algorithmic. Yeah. You're just working your way through it. So, all right. So a Rubik's cube is 3x3, right? So imagine if you had a 9x9 cube, okay? There's still an algorithm to solve it, but it's just more steps, okay? So you're still following a process, but the 9x9 cube is, by some definitions, it's harder because it takes you longer, all right? So you can kind of see where I'm going here. So imagine, let's stick with Rubik's cubes for a minute here. Imagine a 100x100 side cube, right? Or a 1,000x1,000. You know, let's leave aside the physical manufacturing concerns, right?
Okay.
It's going to take you longer and longer and longer and longer to solve this. And eventually, even if you're following the checklist, you're going to reach a Rubik's cube that is longer than a human lifespan. So we're starting to get sort of a rough analogy of the idea of a generation puzzle. So there is a class of puzzle makers and puzzle solvers who in recent years, it's gotten more popular, but it's an old concept of a puzzle that might take a very, very, very long time to solve, such that you might pass it down to your children. You might start working on this generation puzzle. And you know what? My time's up. I got part of the way through it. Here
no
you go,
way.
Kids. Yeah.
But you just don't have closure.
It's not for everybody. Karen, I know that you are the kind of person. I know that you're the kind of person who wants to see it through to the end. There are some very, very fun artisan level, well-made puzzles for sale that fall into this category. Kubia Games, for one example, they sell a puzzle called the this is the name of the puzzle. It's a puzzle lock. It comes in the shape of like a padlock, all right? And your task is to open it. It is called the 341,718,750 move generation puzzle lock. It sells for over $400. It is not a cheap toy. It is a work of art as well as a generation puzzle. This is their own description. If you're buying this, be warned. There are a minimum of 341 million, etc. moves required to open this lock. And it involves sliding, you know, little knobs, basically, in just the correct sequence. As the name implies, it might take a generation or two to open the lock. Assuming you work around the clock, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and average 2 seconds per move, the puzzle will still take you more than 21 years to solve.
No, get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't. I cannot.
Some people would say like, oh, this is beautiful. It's not like, I mean, I will fess up that like as a kid, I certainly took the stickers off a Rubik's cube and kind of solved it the cheap way when I would get frustrated. You know, there's no equivalent here on the 341 million and change move generation puzzle lock. You got to just work the process. You got to just do it, and you do it until you're tired. And then someone else in your family maybe takes over the next shift. And it's almost more a kind of meditation exercise on what does it mean to solve a puzzle? What does it mean to work through a puzzle knowing that you'll never see the end of it?
Would you classify this as hard, though?
That's a really good question. Is like,
it just sounds like it's a lot of busy work.
On some level, isn't that where anything crosses over from
That's
being
true.
Easy to, you know, like Chris, right? Yeah. For example, you know, in the world of level builders, games that have custom level builders, as you well know, there is a whole community, many communities of people, their goal is to make just the most grief-inducing, punishing level possible. And what is solving one of those other than just memorizing the correct sequence, right?
That's
true. It's just trial and error until you get the correct sequence down, and then you punch it, and then you're often very mad when you finish, and you're like, thank God I did it. I never have to do it again. That's hard. That's a kind of hard, right? So I mean, I will leave it up to you to decide if you think that a puzzle that takes 40 years to solve is hard just by virtue of taking 40 years, even if there's a way through to the end, as opposed to you having to figure something out, as opposed to just go through the steps. So back to A.J. Jacobs. A.J. Jacobs decided that as sort of an extension of his love of puzzling, writing about puzzles extensively, sharing them with the world, he was going to commission a puzzle for himself and his family that was the hardest or the longest to solve puzzle ever created. There was some coverage of this in 2022. There was an article on The Atlantic that called it the puzzle that will outlast the world. And that is not being hyperbolic. So A.J. Jacobs partnered with a well-known puzzle designer named Oscar Van Deventer. Basically, Jacobs gave him the challenge of, I want you to create something that is on another level compared to these generation puzzles. 21 years, come on, 50 years, I want something that is astronomical. What Oscar Van Deventer came up with is called Jacob's Ladder. All right, it's a pun on Jacobs, A.J. Jacobs. Yeah, it's clever. Yeah. It's clever. It's good. And the puzzle itself is it's made of wood, and it's kind of a square-ish tower. It's tall, and it sort of has lattice-like structure around the edges. The goal of Jacob's Ladder is essentially to turn wooden pegs, there are many wooden pegs along the sides, in the right sequence to release the center structure. Okay. The thing to take away here is that it is a very elaborate, mathematically based puzzle that you turn a knob, you try and open up the corkscrew shaped rod inside, you solved it. The only problem is how many turns it takes to get there. According to Jacobs and his puzzle designer, there are 1.3 decillion turns required to solve this puzzle, okay? That is the number one followed by 33 numbers, okay? If you twisted one peg per second nonstop, it would take you about 40 septillion years to solve the puzzle. By the time, this is longer than the sun is expected to last. Like the sun will have burned out our planet. We will not be here. Our planet will not be here. It is heat death of the universe type time scales that we're talking about. Not only that, I read, if you rubbed off a single atom due to friction, with every turn, the puzzle would have eroded before you could even get to the end, because it does not even have 1.3 decillion atoms in the puzzle. So it is, unless you break it, it is literally unsolvable. It is not conceivable that as a human race, even, we will ever see the end of Jacob's Ladder.
So it's basically the Tootsie Roll Pop of puzzles. It's like how many turns until you just crack the thing open?
It's more like an installation piece.
Yeah. You know, Jacobs has basically said it's something that he does with his family. You know, he knows that no one in his family is going to see it end. It's meditative. You know that when you're done, you're closer to the end than the beginning.
Okay, Colin, I have a question.
Yeah, yeah.
In your research, have we heard reports where people have completed a generation puzzle?
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Interesting. Well, none of the sort of modern ones that I saw.
Okay.
You know, they say that this is really simplifying a little bit, but you guys are maybe familiar with, like, at this point, the Seven Rings puzzle or the Chinese Rings puzzle, called.
Yeah.
There are a lot of variations on this puzzle that it sometimes is not even rings anymore, but it's basically sort of a binary, you know, type puzzle, right? And if you manipulate something in just the right order, you can pull the rod out of the rings, or you can slide the thing out of the thing. And it's usually a set of seven, you know, turns or something like that. Those games are they seem simpler now, but those are in the family of what were once considered generation games. Yeah. That, like, if you didn't know the pattern, it might take you a year or longer to solve the Chinese rings puzzle once upon a time. You know, it is hard if hard means takes a long time.
Traffic jams. tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
All right, I have one last segment. It's a bit of a story, some trivia. We got some questions in here, so bear with me. This is one of my unhinged story rants of my life. So in my long list of extracurricular activities, I also used to admin a singles dating group for people who run Disney marathons.
I did not know that. How do I not know that?
Wow.
They used to call me Mama Bear. It was a social matchmaking group for Disney fans and runners, marathoners. And because of that group, I got invited to several weddings due to successful pairings.
Wow.
Yes. So a lot of people did find love. And so in 2018, I flew to Orlando to my friends Mike and Candace's wedding. And on the day before the big event, it was really cute. They organized a little 5K around the hotel grounds because we all met running. And afterwards, they had a casual party for all the wedding guests. It was at this party, which was just at someone's hotel room, where Mike, the groom, handed me a can of something I have never seen or heard of before at this point. So this was 2018. This was my first time ever seeing, then tasting, a White Claw. Where were you when you had your first White Claw?
You know what? I can tell you exactly where I was. Yeah. It was a company picnic or something like that. Someone opened up a case and they were all just, oh yeah, we got the white. And I was like, oh, what is this? I've never had one before. And it was 2019. I can tell you exactly when I was. It was 2019. It was summer. Yep.
Karen, I think I was at your house.
Oh, really?
You guys had a party and there were White Claws there.
For those who are minors or those who live outside of the United States, a White Claw is what you call a hard seltzer.
Mm.
It is club soda or flavored just carbonated water with alcohol.
Oh, is that why we're talking about this?
It's hard seltzer, yes. And very briefly, historically, a drink is hard if it has alcohol. And soft if it doesn't, which is why we have soft drinks. Hard, not all the time, but hard can also denote that the alcohol is from distilled alcohol versus fermented alcohol.
Hard liquor.
A beer or wine. Right.
Hard liquor, right? Back to this wedding trip, I remember this moment so clearly because A, it tasted very refreshing because it was just bubble water with alcohol. And two, what a genius idea.
Yeah.
It blew me away. It's not sweet. There's no added sugar. The alcohol is malt. And so it was just at this time, I was like, this is right when the big LaCroix boom. Colin, you had a whole segment in our Underdog episode about the fascinating kind of mind-blowing history of LaCroix.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, people love drinking flavored bubble water. Let's make it alcoholic. It just seemed like a really simple concept, and I can't believe it took so long to get us here. Or did it? So a lot of historical things had to happen to set White Claw and hard seltzers up for success. Like something had to walk in order for White Claw to run or to claw, I guess. That something is the butt of 90s jokes.
Oh, I was hoping we were gonna have an appearance.
Known as,
of course,
Zima, Z-I-M-A. For all you babies out there who don't know, Zima. So trivia question time. What company made Zima?
Was it Anheuser-Busch?
Incorrect.
Was it Miller?
It was Coors, Coors Brewing Company made Zima. Follow-up question, where does the name Zima come from?
Hmm.
Sounds like the end of a word or something.
Yeah, like I was going to say just like very, very 90s or like it, or the beginning of a word, like zemantic acid or so, I don't know, something like that.
Yeah, they like their X's and Z's and like weird, you know, high value letters in the 90s.
So is it zemantic acid?
It's not. Zima means winter in a lot of like Slavic languages. It also sounds like Sima, S-I-M-A, which is a mead alcoholic beverage that traditionally the Finnish people drink. Sima, okay. S-I-M-A.
I can tell you exactly where I was when I had my first Zima, too.
I've never had it.
Because I was
a child.
It's one of those things I wanted to like it. I was in my college dorm room. We had heard, just kind of like through the scene, we had heard that there was this product being test marketed in Sacramento. All right. Now, this was like at college in Berkeley. And so I swear.
That's 2 hours away.
I swear this is what happened. Not me, but my roommate and his buddies, they had heard about this thing. They drove.
No.
They did. I swear. Like after class on a Friday, they got in one of them car. They drove from Berkeley to Sacramento. But so somehow they got their hands in Sacramento on a case of Zima and brought it back to Berkeley.
Wow, what heroes.
And they were like, it was like this big unveiling. It was just this whole, we're all crowded around. Like, we had all heard it's like beer, but it doesn't taste like beer and it's clear. And it's like, oh, okay. I'm like, who is this for? Like, what is this?
Anybody in this room have a problem with beer?
In the most 90s way possible, man. Like, everything had to be clear. Everything had to be a new take. Yeah. It had just this angular kind of designy bottle. It had fluting on it, I remember. I can feel it in my hand. I can feel it in my hand still. And I probably finished it, but I don't think I enjoyed it. It just had a...
How would you describe the taste and the flavor and the
I would describe
experience.
It as it was kind of cloyingly sweet in my memory. It tasted alcoholic. It did not taste like, you know, like the advance was like, oh, it just tastes like you're drinking a soda. And I was like, no, it did not just taste like I was drinking a soda.
I feel like I remember having Zima, but then it's like, am I just remembering Crystal Pepsi? I'm not really sure which one, but it does when you say it, it just seemed like overly sweet and sticky. Like that's sort of, that sounds about right.
So yes, Zima is clear. First of all, Zima is carbonated. Zima is sugary, is sweet. And Zima is lemon lime. You are correct. This is what is called the clear craze. Our electronics were clear. We had a clear Game Boy. We had clear phones. We had clear inflatable furniture for some reason. Like, it was just such a Y2K 90s aesthetic now. But like, for food to be clear, it meant that we didn't add anything to it. Right? That was kind of the visual, shorthand to be like, oh, we didn't treat it. Like, tired of beer and its yellow color that we added? Try this clear thing.
If there was anything bad in here, you'd be able to see it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You can see right through it.
So, trivia question about this. So, obviously, the biggest publicity and marketing campaign for clear products belongs to Crystal Pepsi. A clear Pepsi. Wow. Pepsi's arch nemesis, Coca-Cola, also had a rival colorless soda.
Oh.
What was it called?
Ooh. A colorless cola.
Colorless cola.
Right, because it wasn't...
It's not like Sprite.
Right. Coca-Cola had a colorless cola in the 90s?
Do you think they had the... Did the Coca-Cola company, yes. Did they? Yeah, I was going to say, did they have the confidence to call it Coke, or was it like Diamond Fanta or something like that?
Orbitz? Was it Orbitz?
Oh, I loved Orbitz. Tab Clear.
Really?
Oh...
So not under the Coca-Cola moniker. Tab was Coca-Cola's diet soda.
Right.
It's a separate brand called Tab. This is before Diet Coke. Tab had Tab Clear. So it was their diet cola, but clear.
I think I vaguely remember that. That's funny.
So back to Zima. Zima failed. There are tons of reasons why Zima failed. But to Zima's credit, they did put malt alcoholic beverages on the map. the public consumer awareness map. It helped create this category of drinks, which is sometimes called malternative alcoholic soda or alcopop. Malternative has become its own beverage category. Trivia question. Around the 2000s, what was the name of the viral prank that involved kneeling and chugging a particular malt beverage?
Icing.
Yes.
Oh man, I have not thought about that in several years. Smirnoff Ice, right? Is that what it was? Okay.
Smirnoff Ice, another malternative. How do I even explain the rules of this? If a bottle of Smirnoff Ice is in your line of sight, you have to kneel down and then chug the bottle of Smirnoff Ice. I don't know why we did this.
I think it was an elaborate construct so that people could drink these things and pretend they were doing it ironically when they really just wanted to drink Smirnoff Ice. Yeah.
And one of the things that led to the decline of these hard malt sugary soda drinks was the problem of underage drinking. And so even California tried to raise the taxes on what they call alcopops.
Right.
It could be that, but it also could be people were just becoming more conscious about sugar intake, carb intake at that time. Keto was on the rise. Gluten allergy was starting to get more awareness, and the popularity of LaCroix. All of those things kind of helped make White Claw happen. And thanks to the massive success of hard seltzer, now we're seeing all these other brands trying to make regular drinks hard. There's hard kombucha.
Yes.
There's hard iced tea.
Yes.
There's hard Mountain Dew. Jarritos, the Mexican soda, there's hard Jarritos.
Oh, I didn't see that one.
There is Dunkin' spiked iced coffee.
I've seen the spiked iced coffees. Yeah. And where does like was Mike's Hard Lemonade was another one of these too, right?
Yes.
They were pretty early in that scene, I feel like.
No surprise, Mike's Hard Lemonade, their company also made White Claw.
Okay.
So they dip their toes already in this
very smart
in this category.
Yeah. And it's really about it's about the sugar, right? I mean it's people are drinking a lot fewer sugared drinks, so they're like just looking for something that's like what can get me drunk.
Yeah. I still want to get drunk, don't get me wrong. Yeah.
And that's our show. We've completed Hard Mode.
Woo!
Wasn't that hard? Well, thank you for joining me, and thank you all listeners for listening in. Hope you learned stuff about generation puzzles, hard puzzles, about beetle shells, about Chris's troll quiz. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and on all podcast apps. And on our website, goodjobbrain.com. This podcast is part of Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other shows like The History of Everything, The Movies That Made Us, and Who Arted? We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.